All right, Andy, if you'd like to get started, we're ready.
Thank you, Libby. I appreciate it very much. Good morning, everyone. We appreciate you calling in this morning on what is actually a very nice day here in Washington on a Friday. So as things start to open up on the East Coast here, we hope we'll continue to see some positive movement in things, and hope everyone is doing well and staying safe out there, both your colleagues as well as your families. As usual, I just want to bring up the antitrust statement. If anyone has an issue of something, a road we go down in our discussions, please don't hesitate to let us know, and we will look at that and tack if we need to. So we've got a number of things we want to bring you all up to date on today. We've got just different things that continue to evolve with administrative policy as well as discussions on Capitol Hill, and even some things in at a state level with our state commissioners of ag and others. So encourage you all to continue to bring us up to date on issues you may be experiencing or things that may be impacting your businesses or your customers that we can look at or incorporate into the activities we have ongoing. So please keep us posted, and we appreciate your continued support. Look forward to hearing from you, and hopefully we'll hear from you next week during our continued PLDC activities or our virtual PLDC activities. Hard to believe we were supposed to be in Indianapolis this week. So with that, let me go ahead and turn it over to Jane to start our domestic update. Jane?
Thanks, Andy. I just want to talk about a few of the programs that have already been put in place and some adjustments that are going on there, and then talk a little bit about what we're anticipating to see in the future. One of the new programs is that was authorized under the CARES Act. It's called the USDA Business and Industry CARES Act program. And this program sort of slipped under the radar, so I want to make sure that you guys have noticed it's a loan guarantee program, and USDA expects to fund about $1 billion worth of loans. It is a loan guarantee program for working capital for businesses that have locations in rural areas with populations of 50,000 or less. It's okay if your headquarters is in a larger location, but just you need to have a location in a town that has 50,000 or less people. So the maximum loan is $25 million. They look at working capital as primarily payroll, insurance, rent, and mortgage payments. And we will be sending a link out for that program on the USDA website. Any lender can use that program. And if you've used the Paycheck Protection Program, you're still able to access this loan guarantee program as well. USDA has also unrolled a direct payment program for farmers who experienced price losses between January and April. And we have confirmed that corn and soybean seed producers can access those payments as well. The payment for corn averages about 33 cents a bushel, and for soybeans, 0.475. So it is program that is not, people feel it's not sufficient to address all of the losses that have been experienced, but it is certainly helpful for what has been happening to producers who have lost value in their commodities. That program is also available for specialty crop producers and horticulture producers as well. Many of you probably also saw that the PPP program, there was some adjustments that were made to it by Congress and that the president signed into law last week. So that extends the covered period for loan forgiveness from 8 weeks after the date of disbursement to 24 weeks, which was requested by a lot of small businesses who wanted additional flexibility. It also lowers the requirement for how much of the loan needs to be paid for payroll. So it was 75%, and it lowers that to 60% for loan forgiveness. And I just put a plug in here, and Ellen will talk about it a little bit more. we're going to do an additional webinar relative to the PPP program and those loan forgiveness regulations as well. So as I mentioned, you know, there continues to be quite a lot of need in the ag value chain. VAPRI released a report this week showing that farm incomes, even with all the government support, are down $3 billion this year. So the need is still there. The Congress is working on another stimulus package. The House version actually passed. It was called the HEROES Act. But the Senate has been much slower in taking up that legislation. Our hope is that they will address this before they go on recess for August, but that is not guaranteed. The negotiations between the Democrats and the Republicans have not really begun in earnest, and I would say that both groups are still pretty far off in what they're looking for in that stimulus package. Just noting that in that HEROES Act that passed the House, although it doesn't have a great shot of being adopted in the Senate, the ag portions of that bill were pretty much agreeable to most folks, and they addressed most issues. It did increase CRP acreage, which was a surprise for us. So what are some of the new things that are under consideration? There will be additional direct payments for farmers. Particularly, I think there's a recognition that the CFAP program that I just mentioned for specialty crops, horticulture and floriculture, it's not worked completely smoothly. And so they need to make sure that those parts of the industry do get money. Their Farm Bureau and other farm groups would like to see additional adjustments to the PPP program so farmers can use those. There's also ideas about loan direct grant programs for states, so the ag value chain could have access to grants for testing and PPE and other things like addressing how to dispose of animals that have had to be culled and things like that. Liability protection for businesses is a big topic of conversation. I think this is one of the highest priorities for Republicans, and I do expect to see something in the final bill. Also want to address the needs of ethanol producers who have been really hard hit in recent months, and there's a number of different proposals on the table for that. There's also looking at tax credits for workers, tax credits for employers, funding for rural broadband is another high priority, and of course, increasing domestic food purchases. For those people who watch the cover crops, initially had thought this might be in a stimulus bill. Now I think it will probably move on its own before that, which is changing the hay and grazing date for prevent plant acres, moving that from November 1 to September 1. There's quite a lot of energy right now behind asking USDA to address that. So that's what's happening on the programmatic front. And then I think I'll just move right into the H-2A conversation. We have been made aware of difficulties bringing H-2A workers into the state of Nebraska. But so far, that is the only state where we've heard about problems that are being experienced. We've updated USDA has updated their website with H-2A information, and we also have updated our website with some new updates from the Department of Labor related to H-2A. But generally, things seem to be going smoothly. I know that there are concerns about health considerations related to field labor, and we're going to touch on that later in the session today. And then I just would finish by saying Pat reports things are pretty quiet in the state, so he's going to give up his time for the state update today, and we'll just move right into Q&A.
Thanks, Jane. Do we have any questions out there from the folks on the line?
Like the announcement said, you can push 01 to ask a question or email me, ezimmerman@betterseed.org. We do have a question in the queue here.
Hi, this is Kelly from Bayer. I'm not sure if this is the appropriate time to ask a question, so please excuse me as I'm speaking out of turn. But my question was related to the secure rules, and I recently found out that Bio has sat down with, like, the grain seed folks to kind of, like, talk through their thoughts on the secure rule. I guess that's the best way to put it. And I want to know if ASTA was doing something similar as well.
Shane, I can take this if you want. This is Brian.
Thanks. Yes.
Thanks, Kelly. Yeah, we, in fact, I have an appointment next week with the National Grain and Feed Association to talk about where we are with the secure rule and kind of to compare notes. And also, there are some recent developments in Europe that I want to talk to them about, not related to the secure rule, but related to regulatory developments in France in particular.
Thank you.
I should also mention that HASTA, at the level of the International Seed Federation, has ongoing discussions with the international grain industry, not on necessarily on the secure rule per se, but on the overall regulatory development worldwide.
I'm not seeing any other questions in the queue right now, so I think we can move on into the international update. If you do have a question, push 01. That'll put you in the queue, or you can email me, ezimmerman@betterseed.org. Go ahead,
Great.
Abigail.
Thanks, Ellen. So I will keep this relatively short, touching on seed movement, transportation in and out of our ports as well as global trade. The restrictions on the travel of people across the U.S. border, both to Mexico and Canada, remain in place until June 22nd. And right now the governments are currently discussing whether that will be lifted or extended for an additional period of time. But cargo is still moving across those borders, and movement of persons for essential reasons is still permitted. In terms of ports, the ILWU Longshore Labor Union announced that West Coast ports will be closed next Friday, which is June 19th, in observance of George Floyd. So no cargo will be moving in and out of the ports that day. So just to be aware, we've heard some feedback that, cargo overall is reduced moving into our maritime ports due to COVID. There are some gridlocks in certain areas just due to reduced staffing, so that's for your awareness. Logistics issues do continue to be a challenge, but a little bit less so than at the beginning of the pandemic. And as always, please don't hesitate to contact me or Rick if you have any specific concerns, either moving seed in and out of the U.S. or in another country. In terms of global trade, there was a new report released this week from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, known as OECD, and basically they predicted global economic growth based on two scenarios. So the first scenario would be if the pandemic has already peaked and we're in a period of, decreasing, flattening the curve. And the second scenario would be if another round of rapid spread would occur later in the year. So they predicted, based on those two models, global economic growth for 2020 predicted to drop by 6% under the first scenario and 7.5% if there's a second wave. In the U.S., GDP would drop by a little bit larger margin, 7.3% in the first scenario or 8.4% in the second wave. But there's two pieces of good news on this. They're predicting in 2021 economic growth will increase regardless of the two scenarios, by 5% if the virus keeps diminishing, or 2.8% if there's a second wave. And the other thing to point out is that the food and agriculture sector is faring a lot better than the aggregated economic outlook. We don't have specific numbers on that from OECD, but overall, you know, the food and ag markets are doing better than, you know, heavy machinery, auto industry, retail. So we're continuing to look at that. We're continuing to look at how that might affect markets in the next coming years, and we'll continue to keep you updated. So now I'll turn it over to Rick for a phytosanitary update.
Okay, thank you, Abigail. Just a couple of quick things on the phytosanitary front. First of all, regarding COVID-19 impacts, there really isn't much change from the last call. However, the pandemic seems to be worsening in South America primarily, and with a real emerging problem, rapidly escalating problem, if you will, in Brazil. But seed movements are continuing. This is something, though, that we're watching very closely. I check in with the APHIS trade directors quite frequently to see what's happening both there and in particular in Asia. So if you guys hear anything different or you have new information, please don't hesitate to forward that my way. Also, on the last call, I talked a little bit about the federal orders for tomato seed. And this week, APHIS did officially issue an amendment to its federal order on tobacco brown rugose fruit virus federal order. And it primarily focuses on the tomato fruit. So let me just, there are three points here. First of all imported tomato and pepper plants for planting must be from countries certified free of the disease, or the plants have to be tested and certified free of the disease. So, of course, there's a lot of transplants that go into greenhouse operations and so forth. Secondly, all tomato and pepper fruit imported from the Dominican Republic, France, Spain, Israel, Mexico, Canada, and the Netherlands must be inspected at the point of origin and certified free of symptoms of TOBRFV. And then thirdly, only commercial consignments of tomato and pepper fruit from all countries authorized to ship to the U.S. are allowed. So those are the major things. And again, they all pretty much focus on fruit. But the other thing they announced along with that federal order is that they're planning to conduct a domestic TOBRFV survey primarily in commercial greenhouses, which will be in partnership with the states through a program called the Cooperative Agricultural Pest Survey Program, or CAPS program. And APHIS is also kicking in some funds out of its detection budget. This is important because there have been, last fall, there were some isolated detections in greenhouses. And for the U.S. to maintain its official status as free from TOBRFV, they have to follow up those activities, those official control activities, with a survey to document absence in the rest of the country. So already I've gotten a few questions about the survey. It will be, as I said before, in commercial greenhouses. And so should TOBRFV be detected and confirmed, APHIS will issue emergency action notifications on properties that are impacted, and will work with those property owners to isolate, contain, control, and eliminate the virus. They'll do trace investigations to identify the source of the infection and to identify where any potentially infected plant material may have been moved. So the focus, I think, is going to be on plants and transplants. Perhaps it could end up as an isolated scenario on seed. We'll just have to wait to see what happens. But My sense is that they're not going to find much. This is a disease that once it's there, you see it, and it rapidly escalates in a greenhouse scenario. But anyway, just wanted to let you know that. We're going to be in more dialogue with APHIS on the details of that survey, And it also will be a subject for next week's monthly call. Every month we do have a stakeholder call with APHIS to go through various seed issues, and this will be on that agenda. So if you're interested in participating in that call, it is next Thursday at 2 p.m., let me know, and I'll forward you the dial-in information for that. So that's pretty much what I have for today. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Rick. We'll move into Q&A for our international folks. So if you have a question for Abigail or Rick, push 01 to enter the queue and ask over the phone or email me, ezimmerman@betterseat.org. Looks like we have a question here. You're unmuted. Go ahead and ask your question. Okay. If you do have a question and we're not able to hear you, you can go ahead and email me, ezimmerman@betterseat.org. And I'm not seeing any other questions right now, so we'll move into our lessons learned section of the agenda, and we'll be hearing from some of AFSA members about how they're implementing some COVID guidance into practice within their company. So I will turn it over to Brad Fruth with Bex.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. Appreciate the time here and appreciate everybody's time as we have this discussion. We've been asked to share some thoughts around health screenings and things that we're doing with our employee population at Bex Hybrid. So one of the things that we have been doing is, number one, I'm sure those of us that have offices in multiple states, it's almost a full-time job keeping up with the changing conditions that every state is issuing. But currently, what we are doing is asking our employees to self-screen as our primary way of screening our employees that work in our offices and our production areas. This would be before you show up to work every day, check your temperature. If you have a cough or shortness of breath, muscle or body aches, and then obviously if you've been exposed to anybody that has tested positive, please stay home. We do have the benefit. We have a nurse practitioner on staff that primarily does our occupational health and CDL physicals. She is coordinating all of our care. So what we've kind of done is made her the point person. If anybody has questions on should they quarantine, if they've had a family member that has tested positive, what should they do about their personal health, she is serving as that advisor for them. We've also made a member in our safety group kind of the point person on any PPE needs. So we've been able to kind of have one person in the organization that they can go to for questions around quarantine and then questions on any PPE needs. Now, we are taking a little bit different stance with our farm workers and those that are living in close quarters, but for the most part, for our office staff, this is the protocol that we're implementing. Now, when they come into the office or they're working, we're definitely adhering to the CDC guidelines on maintaining social distancing with signs and propaganda about washing hands. We're continuing to clean as many work surfaces as we can throughout the day. So one of the other things that I'll just share briefly, we do have a short little protocol that we have come up with when an employee does test positive. And so our current protocol on that is to, number one, the care of that employee is of utmost importance, so make sure that we're coordinating quarantine and protocol with them immediately. The second thing is we then shut off access to that employee's workspace and let it sit for 24 hours. Then after that, we have a member of our on-site safety team comes in and disinfects the workspace that that employee was working in or the work environment, any shared bathroom, hallways, that sort of thing. Then after the disinfecting is done, then we let all the employees return. And then at this point, those employees that worked in close quarters, we manually screen those employees with a thermometer and run them through the self-assessment questions. Then our nurse practitioner manages the care of that employee and then with the appropriate quarantine and then a return to work. So that's kind of how we've been handling the screening. And then also if a positive case does come up, that's how we have been handling ourselves there. So at this time, I will turn it over to Monty to talk about field labor.
Yeah, thank you very much, Brad. Appreciate the feedback. My name is Monty McCoy. I am Director of Corporate Services for Cicada America Holdings. Our COVID journey kind of started a little bit early here in California. We started around the beginning of March to understand that we were going to need some kind of reaction because we were seeing signals in the marketplace or in the local community that COVID was becoming more active. I had recently returned from a IT event in Phoenix where COVID around the world was being kind of featured as starting to emerge. So when I got back, it just seemed the right approach to sit down with the senior management team and begin to think about what we needed to do moving forward. So by mid-March, we had created our our stay-at-home policy, and we had created a COVID alert status that we published to our entire workforce across the region, and began to operate as a distributed business for the majority of our office staff, and we began to conceptualize some of our co-location needs for sites where staff are required. So we as a management team, we started thinking about how we could structure ourselves to be able to properly respond to that. So we defined two approaches. One was a pod-based approach for our warehouse personnel. So we have 2 4-by-10 shifts that run each week or continuously, back-to-back. We essentially split our staff into two groups, two teams. And the first team reports the first 4 days, and the second team reports the next 4 days, and then they rotate. We've introduced enhanced cleaning protocol as early as the beginning of March. We started to update and enhance our cleaning protocol at all of our locations. And then as we got more into the pod structure, and as we started to launch that, we recognized too that this might not be the best solution for our co-located sites where we have research and genetics and we have pollination and trial production. And so we needed to think of a different way to approach those groups. So we designed what we call internally the zone concept for those sites that are non-warehouse. And it involves supporting the contract labor that is on those locations in addition to our full-time staff. They are not split into two working groups so much that they're shifting like the warehouse personnel. They are reporting primarily all at the same time, but instead they are restricted somewhat to zones. They are allowed and they are asked to stay within the zones that they've been appointed to. And then any other communication on site is done virtually, you know, through digital communications, FaceTime or whatever. Let's see. So far we've been extremely fortunate, I think we owe that to a lot of diligence within our staff, within our organization. Everyone has become very mindful about how the virus spreads, and so we're operating within those constraints. But that's how we're managing our locations from a field labor standpoint. And I'll turn that over to Toby Ritberger for the introduction of Field Days activities.
Well, good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to be on the call. Toby Ritberger, Event Logistics Lead here at Bex Hybrids. Just wanted to share a little bit about our events and Field Days. We are moving forward with in-person events, of course, to start following all state guidelines, CDC recommendations, and moving forward. We are doing extra things. Of course, when we look at those events, some events, even here in the short term, with Indiana moving to phase four here today, looking at some events outside where we've moved events to 100% outside following social distancing and going through those guidelines. And then, of course, at all events, making things available like masks and sanitizers, increasing cleaning crews, looking at changing. We've actually changed how we serve lunch and how any food is handled. We're going to a pre-proportioned, pre-packaged lunch in those events. Also looking at increasing seating opportunities in those events and actually having outdoor seating as well. Increased amount of signage, which I think is going to be key, whether that's signage at registration, signage on the event, signage in each of the different areas where we have those. So signage and communication is going to be huge. And then I think when we talk about field shows and moving forward with live events, one of the biggest things we have to be willing to do is just to be flexible and being able to work with all the guidelines as we move and change through this scenario. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to questions and answers.
Great. Thank you, Brad, Monty, and Toby. Really appreciate your time and being willing to share with us this morning. They're also willing to answer questions. So if anyone has a question for Brad, Monty, or Toby, again, that's 01 to unmute, or I'm sorry, to get in line for a question on the phone, or you can email me, bzimmerman@betterseat.org.
Brad, maybe I'll kick off the questions. This is Jane. I had a question when you were talking about what you do after you find out that somebody has COVID in one of your facilities. And I noticed you're following the protocol to shut the workspace down for 24 hours before cleaning. You said, are you shutting down your whole facility or just the workspace where that person was primarily working?
So I think it depends on the situation, but primarily that recommendation is coming from I believe the CDC that is allowing all the particles in the air to settle and the virus will basically die outside of a human at that point. So right now, the times we've had to implement the protocol, it's mainly been like a workspace area and maybe a bathroom and a hallway. It's been relatively contained. You know, we've also tried with our employees, we're not mixing population groups right now. I mean, it's not a policy, but just because of people's personal lives and stuff that's going on, we don't have a lot of people traveling from one location to another. So it's been relatively small right now, and we've been very blessed with the fact that we have not had to shut down a facility. However, we have reserved the right to do that should we need to. And that comes really out of an abundance of caution in order to protect everyone. I would maybe just add the couple of times that we've seen employees have this, we've not had any issues of a retransmission. Most of it's been someone's been at an event or something. Our offices and locations have not been a source of anything. So far the protocols are working well.
Ellen, I'll ask another question if we don't have any in the queue.
We don't have any in the queue right now. Go for it, Jane.
Okay. Well, it was sort of a question / comment. I was in our local paper here in D.C. today. There was an article about migrant labor being a source of infection in Florida, and I was dismayed to see a picture of a very full bus of laborers, nobody wearing masks. I think some of the windows were open, and I know when David Atchison spoke to us 2 weeks ago, he talked about trying to move, you know, add additional transportation and so you can create some spacing in buses. And if you can't, making sure people wear masks. And, you know, I just think it's unfortunate when pictures like that are out or if people are not, you know, if folks are not taking it seriously with their own workers. Certainly sounds like you guys are doing everything you can, but that's so important. I just feel like that picture in and of itself will, you know, start to give us a black eye in ag.
So, I mean, we have been from the Beck side. We have a couple of different labor pools that we use for that in a number of different states. All the state regulations are different. I will tell you in Indiana here, the one part of the process where that can get a little ouchy is that bus transportation. So we have increased the number of buses. There's a pretty robust cleaning protocol. The other thing that we have also done that is in the state of Indiana, they have a very robust testing network, but it's only available to people that have an in-state driver's license. And we've been able to coordinate with the Department of Ag in Indiana and the Board of Health that if we had a concern that the population staying in our housing were to have an outbreak, they have strike teams available. And so instead of sending them to a public testing place, we were able to get some assurances from the State Board of Health that we would basically, at that place, we would make a call to them and the Department of Ag, and then they would bring a strike team out, which is essentially an on-site testing group, so that we could keep them contained and also kind of work around some of the policies that they have regarding public testing. Now, working with some folks in Iowa, it's a little bit different. In Iowa, we are using a labor contractor there, but they have been working with some local partners to get access to that should we have to exercise that option. So, you know, we are doing everything that we can to protect that workforce as well as our office and production floors.
Hi, this is Andy Levine with ASTA, and I really appreciate you guys getting on because one of the things that we've talked about is this topic for all of us is not a topic of competition at all. It's a topic of how do we help each other address some of the issues in front of us and share, you know, knowledge and that kind of thing. Question comes from that standpoint of each of your areas. I'm sure you've got some protocols in place as far as, you know, the testing that, Brad, you talked about or the field labor, Monty, that you did with respect to the interaction in the record keeping. Monty, from your standpoint, if something happens, how do you trace back? Or, Brad, you know, if you're having everyone do their temperature testing, are you keeping records? Or what are your thoughts about record keeping, you know, for long-term or liability purposes? Anything you can share with them there?
That's a good question. We Andy, this is Monty.
Yeah, we've established some internal protocols, and so far we haven't had a positive case. But in the cases where we've had suspected infection, we have, you know, initiated some record keeping. So we keep as much of the high level information as we need to, you know, identify the incident, to potentially identify any tracking and tracing or isolation requirements. We model it against that track and trace kind of process that we've defined internally. And then what we do, though, is record, like I said, the least amount of information that will help us track the incident, but not reveal any of the personal private information about the person who might be impacted. ASHA has now expected us to report any COVID exposure or any COVID infection. So we have to keep some record of that if that occurs. So we're preparing ourselves to keep the minimum amount of information as possible while protecting the user's privacy. And so far, so good. So that's what we're doing at Cicada.
Yeah, and as I mentioned from the Beck side, with having an on-staff nurse practitioner, she has a HIPAA-compliant health record system already. So we're not keeping any daily information, but when we do have people that we're making a decision around quarantine or a positive case, all that is being kept in their system. And one of the things that we've tried to be very aware of is, and I think the lines are a little gray, but you know, you do have to respect your employees' privacy from a healthcare standpoint. But yet you also have to make sure that you're notifying other people of a potential issue. And so I don't know if anybody has that figured out, but those are the things in discussions of, you know, if we're going to implement a cleaning protocol, we don't, you know, we're not going to come in and say, hey, guess what? Toby Rittberger just tested positive. You know, number one, we can't say that from a HIPAA standpoint, but at the same point, we do have to, we're in doing screenings and things of that nature. So from a record keeping standpoint, we're relying on our nurse practitioner in a HIPAA compliant system to store all that if it's needed at a later date.
Thanks. That's helpful.
Okay, I'll do a last call for questions for Toby, Brad, and Monty. Okay, hearing none, thank you for your time this morning. Really appreciate you joining us and sharing how you guys have put guidance into practice. I'm going to go over some of the latest resources really quick. Again, we have a COVID-19 hub on our website, betterseed.org, and you can get to that under the news tab. We have a few new resources within that hub. On the employer and labor tab, you can find EPA statement on respirator shortages and pesticide application, a CDC guidance for reopening office buildings, and a new CDC guidance for manufacturers. On the loan programs tab, you can find a Business and Industry Cares Act program resource. The state tab has some newly added California resources. And the other resources tab, there's some new things under USDA. There's the USDA and FDA considerations for prioritization of PPE and some helpful links there for a buyer's guide and supplier wholesale association there. We are continuing to update the member-only portal with resources as well. You can access the members-only site by clicking login in the top left corner of betterseed.org. Or there are links within the COVID-19 hub as well. If you're having issues logging in, you can email me at ezimmerman@betterseed.org or give me a call, 419-618-7167, and I'd be happy to help set you up with some credentials. We're always taking suggestions on resources that you may need. So if there's something specific you're looking for or an area you have a lot of questions, please let us know so that we can work on scheduling webinars with industry experts or finding those resources. Jane mentioned earlier that we're working on a webinar. So Todd Martin of IPSA and Jane are working on a joint IPSA-AFTA webinar that'll be held on June 26th. And it's going to be focused on PPP loans with an emphasis on loan forgiveness. So June 26th, mark your calendar for that. We'll, of course, send out notice and details around that. Finally, be sure to join us for the Ask the Annual Membership meeting on Tuesday, June 16th at 2 o'clock p.m., and that's Eastern Time. You can register on the PLDC virtual website. And if you have trouble finding that website or have questions around the annual meeting, shoot me an email or give me a call. So that's what I have for our latest resources. Jane, Andy, any closing thoughts?
Thanks, Ellen. We appreciate that very much. As Ellen said, in our conversations with Todd Martin with IPSA, he brought this up and just thought that we ought to work or collaborate on the PPP issue and that loan forgiveness to make sure that growers have as much information or our members have as much information as possible to comply with that and help them along that line. We'll continue to do those type of events as they come up, much like we did with the previous event just on complying with opening offices back up. And as Ellen said, please don't hesitate if there's some things that you'd like some guidance or insight on. We could find people who can provide guidance and insight into certain policies. We're working on that as much as we possibly can, and we're ready to do that. But sometimes we just need to hear what's impacting you all. So we look forward to pulling that event together. On that note, Jane, do you have any parting comments?
No, we keep reading our updates that we send out weekly, also on the off weeks that we don't have these sessions.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Please join us next Tuesday for our member meeting. We've got a good speaker from USDA Biotechnology Regulatory Services under APHIS, and she's going to bring us up to date on our recent Part 340 revisions that they have put in place and are beginning to implement. And we'll also have updates on various other ASTA activities. So that's next Tuesday. Let us know if you have any questions or any issues facing you, and we look forward to hearing from you soon. Thank you, everyone. Be safe out there, and have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you.